And welcome to Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Bailey Lamont.
And we are talking today about the horrific conditions that you find in the prisoner justice complex. That is, in this city, we have our own little detention center popped out off Exeter Road, called the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center, or EMDC. And this has been a hot potato since 2000.
Yeah.
Okay, this baby has not been going away. Prison conditions in this country have been dramatically dropping since a particular conservative government has gotten into power.
As the amount of prisoners increase?
As the amount of prisoners increase due to the tough on crime agenda. Oh, so, you know, as we deal with overcrowding in our prisons so that our illustrious prime minister can justify privatizing prisons and letting his buddies into Canada because the U.S. is booting them out. So we're going to deal with this prison concept, and we're going to deal with this class action suit that lawyer Kevin Eden has put against the Ministry of Consumer Affairs. And, you know, the Minister of Consumer Affairs, she's on the hot seat. And, you know, to get us started here, this is Peggy Sadler, our London West MP, taking her to town on this very issue.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services. Speaker, this past weekend, Adam Cargas was brutally beaten and murdered at the Elgin Middlesex Detention Centre. On Monday, the Minister shared with this House the number of inmates at EMDC on the night of the murder, but failed to tell us the number of correctional officers. We now learn that there were only two officers overseeing three units with a total of 150 inmates when there should have been two officers in each unit that night. Does the minister believe that this is the right level of staffing to ensure inmate and officer safety?
Minister of Community Services and Corrections.
Mr. Speaker, so the member, you know, is speculating on, you know, how many staff there was there. I know that the EMDC capacity was under capacity that day, and I also know that you know, we have done a lot to improve the safety of both our inmates and our security, our correctional officer in EMDC, and I'm going to continue to work with both the union and the management to make sure that the situation does improve at EMDC. As I said, you know, we have installed 350 security camera, a new control module, metal detector, and we have increased a correctional officer by 11 in the facility. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Speaker. Again, to the Minister. The Minister is repeating what she told us on Monday, that these new security cameras and these new enhancements are the solution to violence at EMDC. And it's true that the cameras help the police identify and lay charges against the suspects after the fact, but they did not prevent Adam Cargas from losing his life. When is the Ministry going to fix the design flaws at EMDC, implement direct supervision, and prevent tragedies like this from ever happening again?
You go, Peggy. So, yeah. and you know, I want to point out that those security cameras were just recently installed in that facility. And up until that point, we had cameras in our schools, we have cameras in the mall, but we had no cameras in our jails. And they only had audio monitoring of the yard and the public places for the prisoners up until very recently when they installed video cameras. So if an incident happened, you had to scream for help, and a lot of good that did when somebody's arm is across your throat and you can't talk.
Yeah, and I mean, it also makes it easier for guards to not be accountable too, right?
Absolutely.
The abuse that they commit.
Exactly. Absolutely. So we're talking about EMDC, and Kevin Eden has filed this class action lawsuit against the Minister of Consumer Relations and the government. And so I sat down with him last week and had a chat about this. This is Kevin Eden.
My name is Kevin Egan. I'm a partner at Mackenzie Lake Lawyers here in London.
Start with your work at EMDC. What brought that about?
Well, it was it kind of just fell in my lap. I got a cold call from someone who was at the bank across from my office and who knew the Drysdale family and wanted to help them out because Randy Drysdale had just died while in custody at Elgin Middlesex Detention Center. She put me in touch with the family, and I became involved in ultimately in an inquest. Randy Drysdale was killed in 2009. The inquest finally got underway in 2011. During that inquest, it was a real eye-opener to me what was going on right here in London, Ontario. That people were being beaten on a daily basis, that the prison was incredibly overcrowded, that there was a culture of fear and violence that just ran the institution. And there was a lack of supervision, a lack of training, a lack of medical care. There was filth, and people were not being rehabilitated. They were being mistreated. And coming out of the prison system worse than they came into it. So it's not a rehabilitative system whatsoever. Part of the, I had argued at that inquest that Randy Drysdale died as a result of a homicide. The institution had labeled it an accident, and I was the only one of five lawyers who appeared on that inquest who argued homicide. The jury agreed with me that it was a homicide, and they made a number of recommendations, many of which have still not been implemented or were rejected by the ministry. But I pledged to that family that I would work to try to prevent something similar happening to another family. And for the last 2.5 years since that inquest, I have been at every opportunity voicing my concern that someone else was going to die at Elgin Middlesex Detention Center. And unfortunately, I was right. Halloween night this year, 2013, Adam Kargus was murdered at Elgin Middlesex Detention Center. And the same systemic problems that were identified in 2011 and frankly should have been identified in 2009 were the root cause. There's a culture of fear and violence. There's overcrowding. There's lack of supervision. And that's why Adam Kargus died. Nobody was watching and protecting him. Over the course of the last couple of years, I have had countless inmates, former inmates, meet with me either here or at the jail, and recount stories of horror that I could not believe was happening in a civilized country. People are beaten, they're tortured, they're psychologically damaged. Their drugs that are prescribed by medical practitioners are withheld from them, or they're beaten up and forced to give them to the meanest, toughest inmates in the cell block. They're abused by guards. They're laughed at when they're hurt. They're not getting proper medical attention. And these grown men, these guys who have a tough exterior, come in and they speak to me, and they break down in tears because of what's happened to them. And it's simply wrong. Somebody has to do something. And so I have tried, and I'm sometimes I feel like a voice in the wilderness trying to wake up this government to make sure that other people don't suffer, that families don't have to bury a loved one. And I'll tell you, it's a frustrating experience, and it's something that I never thought would happen in a country that I was proud to be a citizen of.
Well, especially, I mean, the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center, that's, I mean, the primary focus of that facility is people with misdemeanors, correct?
Well, it's a detention center, so people who are in there may be awaiting trials or sentencing on very serious crimes. Some are in there simply waiting for a bail hearing, and some are sentenced to 2 years less a day and may serve those sentences there. So there's quite a mixture of the demographics. Some of those inmates are innocent of anything. They have never been convicted of a crime, and in fact, many of them after a trial are released and after being found not guilty. But they still have suffered all of those abuses that I just mentioned.
So what do we need to do about this?
Well, I think it's a matter of changing the political will. You know, I'm seeing a bit of a shift in public perception of this, having spoken about it for quite some time now. Initially, people were saying, well, they're just prisoners. They deserve whatever they get. And I'm seeing a bit of a shift in that attitude towards, wow, I didn't know that was happening. Wow, I didn't know that one of my loved ones could end up in there and be exposed to that kind of danger. You know, this is not the kind of society I thought we were. I am seeing that sentiment, and you see it in the comments in the newspaper, on the online newspapers where people write in their comments, that there is a bit of a shift. But the government needs to wake up and stop playing a game and actually fix the problem.
Well, I mean, the federal government is talking about making new mega jails and stuff, but they're talking about privatizing the system, and I'm assuming that you don't think that's a solution.
Well, I don't know if privatizing might be a solution. I know that there is labor unrest at Elgin Middlesex Detention Center that may be contributing to the lack of supervision or the conditions that are out there. Whether privatization is the answer, I don't know. But there needs to be a cultural shift within that facility. There needs to be a change so that people are actually respected as human beings, because they're not now. You know, some of the guards out there are decent people. Some of them are not. And there's a phenomenon known as slippage, where good people exposed to bad behaviors over an extended period of time sort of change their mores and begin to let things slide until bad behavior becomes the norm for everyone. And I'm afraid that that's part of the problem out there is that it's just kind of accepted that every day out there somebody is going to get punched out and seriously injured.
Daily?
Daily. Every day. The statistics show that there's a reported assault about once every 36 hours. But the ministry themselves would admit that most assaults go unreported. And that's because of this culture of fear. If you say, hey, this guy just beat me up, what's going to happen to you? You're not going to be let out of jail free. You're going to have to stay in jail and face him and his friends, their revenge for you having been a rat. And so if you say something like that, you face the prospect of being beaten or killed. So this culture of fear is something that they know about. It's called the inmate's code. And they're well aware that when inmates show up with broken facial bones and lacerations, that probably they got beaten up, but they say they slipped and fell in the shower, because that's the only way that they can prevent it from happening again.
These are all horrible stories, and I mean, I've heard some personal accounts firsthand on stuff that has happened out there. And what do you say to people when they say to you they're just prisoners?
Well, you know, it's upsetting to hear that, obviously, that people in this day and age would take that attitude. You know, these guys, many of them grew up in disadvantaged circumstances. They never really had a chance in life and probably were always destined to end up in the prison system because we don't have the social supports necessary to protect them from ending up there. We don't have the mental health facilities in this province. We don't have the services to deal with drug addiction. We have an epidemic of childhood abuse that's not properly addressed. All of those things lead to these human beings ending up in our provincial detention centers. They're not inherently bad people. But, you know, it's more convenient to say that than to actually confront it. And so I say to those people that they are actually prisoners of their own ignorance and their own prejudice. They need to educate themselves.
And how do they get that education?
Paying attention, you know, turning their minds to what I've just said, that who are these people that are ending up in Elgin Middlesex Detention Center? They're kids who in grade six in the East End of London are presented with a crack cocaine pipe, and they smoke it, and they're lost forever to their family. They're kids who come from broken homes, whose father was abusive to them, and they grow up not knowing any different. They're children of drug addicts themselves. They're the people that have fallen through the cracks because we haven't been there to pay attention to their plight.
Let's talk about some of those cracks, because I spend time in the courthouses and I see, you know, there's certain people that come in with legal representation and you know, they get the first times and they're there, they come in, they come out, and you know, it's fairly quick, and then you have the unrepresented people that pack the courthouse. Why do we have so many unrepresented people in the system these days?
On the civil side, you know, I'm trying to find a civil solution for these people who have been denied their constitutional right to security of the person or to be free from cruel and unusual treatment or punishment. And, you know, from that side of it, there are funding difficulties. You know, basically, I'm doing all of this work without having been paid. I only get paid when and if I win the case. So there aren't a lot of lawyers in town that are willing to take on this type of case under those circumstances. So that's an access to justice problem as well. There should be, especially when the constitutional issues are at the forefront, there should be some means to pay for legal representation.
So how many people do you have under the class action that you filed?
Well, the number is growing every day. I believe I had about 140 individual cases some of which are not EMDC, because, you know, my name's sort of gone out around the province now, and I'm getting calls from other institutions with similar circumstances. You know, I hasten to say that EMDC is the worst of the bunch, but as far as this class action is concerned, I expect that at the end of the day, we'll likely have a class in the thousands. You know, when you consider that that it's spanning a number of years, and that at any given time there's well over 400 people in that institution, an institution that was built to house 150. So, you know, the number is going to be large at the end of the day. But you know, I'm getting inquiries every day.
So, by the numbers you're talking about, does anyone come out of that facility unscathed?
No. No, nobody comes out of that facility having had the opportunity for rehabilitation. Everybody in there spends their time looking over their shoulder to see if there's a bigger, meaner, tougher guy coming after them. They don't have time to quietly reflect on what they've done wrong and how they might improve themselves in the future. They don't have time to develop any kind of respect for the law. Instead, what they're developing in there is a disdain for the law, an alienation from society, because they're treated as if they're somehow subhuman and not deserving of humane treatment. So, yes, everybody has suffered, some to a much greater degree than others. You know, you compare somebody who comes out with their frontal lobe, with their brain missing, or never being able to walk the same again, or having lost the use of an arm or an eye. Compare that to somebody who has just lived in abject fear for months at a time. So, yeah, there's certainly variations in the quantum of damages, but everybody has suffered.
When you go to jail, can you outline for the audience, you still have all of your rights and privilege of freedom, obviously, but human rights still apply to you as an individual.
Absolutely, yes. You're entitled to be treated humanely. The idea of incarcerating people is to deprive them of their liberty. And, you know, part of the objective of sentencing someone to jail is to rehabilitate them. Jail is not a place to punish, within which to punish people. The being removed from society is the punishment that the courts or the law is supposed to promote. It's not meant to send people somewhere where they're going to be beaten or humiliated or deprived of medical care. That, you know, in my view, is actually contrary to the purpose of sentencing somebody to jail.
That is wonderful that you clarified that, because, you know, when I talk to people about jail, they're usually, oh, yeah, they go there and get beat up. That's the purpose of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of jokes about, you know, oh, yeah, well, wait till you meet your cellmate and that kind of thing. You know, people think that that's funny, but it's not. It really is. It's almost like playing Russian roulette with somebody's life, sending them down there. You know, they're jammed into a jail cell with God knows who and maybe his buddy in a cell originally designed for one person. Anybody who goes in there runs a real risk of coming out dead.
I've actually won a few cases for clients of mine that I do some for people that can get absolutely zero legal services. I'll represent them in POA and stuff like that. And I've actually gotten them out of jail time simply because of the human rights conditions at EMDC.
Yeah. I mean, courts are beginning to realize more and more just how bad it is there. You see it reflected in some of the provincial court decisions, you know, where they're getting the maximum that's now allowed under the law, time and a half for time served in there, because the conditions are so bad. But and there's other decisions where judges have said, well, you know, I just don't trust them to keep this person safe. So they reduce their sentences accordingly.
And how is that serving justice in any way?
Well, it's not. It's not offering the rehabilitation that these people ought to get. It's not protecting society. It's it's a Band-Aid. And we have to stop lopping at the branches and go to the root.
Go to the root. Thanks, Kevin. That sums up what we have going on here at EMDC. And, you know, he brought up so many different things. I mean, the medical issues, the treatment of prisoners, the quotes that we hear from inmates in those facilities. I mean, I spent 4 hours in detention underneath the courthouse on a mistaken identity.
Oh.
And because there's a chick with the same name as me that they mistaken her multiple murderer and want outstanding warrants and everything as me. And so I just got scooped up because my name came across a file, and all of a sudden I find myself locked up for 4 hours. And that was, I had these guys in the next cell that, because down there the cells are separated, but they're separated by bars, and that's it. And, you know, and I've got, you know, these scary, scary women in this cell with me that just looked at me because I'm, like, dressed to the nines and looking good, and they're looking at me like I'm candy. And, you know, it was 4 hours, and people say, well, Michelle, get over it. But it, that 4 hours of having my freedom taken away from me, I will never forget for as long as I live.
Absolutely not.
And, you know, taking away somebody's freedom is not something that should be done lightly.
No. No, I've been under the courthouse once in the basement there. I mean, you wanted me to talk about spending the night in jail. Like, I mean, I wasn't in prison. Like, I wasn't at a place like EMDC. I was at the police station just in a holding cell overnight, and that was bad. Not even comparable to what happens in real prisons, and especially at EMDC. But I mean, even if you're just being held overnight, let's say at the police station, if you get arrested for painting on a brick or something, that's
or
what
something
I got arrested
like that
for.
Yeah,
something really, really stupid like that. I mean, even then, it's like, I mean, nobody just, I don't know, like, it's terrible as it is. Like, I mean, you don't eat, they don't give you anything to drink, you don't have a, like, it's freezing, they don't, I mean, I remember asking for a blanket or a sweater or something because I was cold, and they told me no, but they gave one to the woman next to me. So, I mean, in addition, if they know you, if they don't like you so much, then they're not afraid to, you know, make someone else a little bit more comfortable and let you suffer. And I mean, obviously, in a prison at EMDC, that's going to be to an even greater extent.
And you just had overnight.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, like, this was just, like, at the police station. It was nothing, really, compared to what other people are dealing with right now. But even that, for my roommate and I, and for anybody who's been through it, anybody who's been arrested and kept overnight at the police station, we all know that that is bad. So can't even imagine what it feels like to be in prison right now.
Well, after the break, we are going to have some people tell us just how bad in their own words. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes here on Between the Margins.
We are all in this together.
back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Bailey Lamond.
And we are talking about the crisis situation at EMDC in London.
Can I say something, Michelle? Just going off of Kevin's interview from before the break and how he described some of the conditions, and at one point he said how to a lot of people, especially the general public, when it comes to their perception of prison and law enforcement and politicians and just the whole idea of prison, people seem to think that the conditions in these places, especially at EMDC, that the prisoners are deserving of these living conditions and human rights violations. And I mean, as a prison abolitionist, I do struggle with questions of, well, you know, despite the fact that most people in prison right now are there for nonviolent crimes, what about those who actually commit violent crimes? The murderers, the rapists, people who we actually don't want walking around on the streets with us for obvious reasons. And I mean, a lot of people who believe that prison should stay the way that they are, that prisoners deserve this kind of treatment, often cite violent criminals as examples of people who deserve that. And I mean, something that a lot of people don't think about is what exactly do prisons do to stop these things? Because they do nothing. Prisons don't stop murder. Prisons don't stop rape. Prisons don't stop any of these things from continuing to happen in our society. They simply contain very few of the people who are doing them. So I mean, that just goes to show that every single struggle, every human rights issue, everything we ever talk about politically is intersectional with the prison industrial complex. It's somehow, in every way, it always goes right back to the prison industrial complex.
Well, there's a joke going around Facebook and the rest of cyberspace, a meme that says, Harper's dealing of homeless and marginalized people is putting them in jail.
Yeah, and the sad part is there are a lot of homeless and marginalized people who are purposely committing crimes to get sent to jail because they feel like they'll live a better life in jail because they have nothing.
Yeah, and that only happens in youth jails, just for the record.
Oh, does it?
Yeah,
okay.
Pretty much. I mean, three meals a day is three meals a day, and if you're starving to death, any conditions are better. But
yeah.
I know a lot of youth that go back into the reform school, youth prison system, because conditions are way better than anything that they can get outside in social service. So,
yeah.
You know, and that costs us, the taxpayer, hundreds of times money, more money than anything else. And here's a clip of Teresa Armstrong who talks about this in the Parliament about the consequences of the conditions at places like EMDC.
Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services. On Monday, a man who fired gunshots at his former manager and terrified a London neighbourhood was sentenced to 7 years. However, he will serve less than half his sentence. The appalling conditions of the jail were cited by the judge as a reason for reducing his sentence. Speaker, is the minister okay with convicted criminals being prematurely released due to the terrible conditions at this jail?
Mr. Speaker, we respect the right of the judge to impose sentences.
Yes.
They deem appropriate under the law. We are aware of the concern regarding EMDC. We have, with the administration of the jail, we have started, we have developed a 12-point plan, and we are working on the improvement of that jail. And I've also suggested what will be implemented. It's to have kind of a board of director for that jail, comprised of citizens in the community, to help us to redress the situation at the EMDC. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Supplementary.
Speaker, the conditions at Elgin Middlesex Detention Center have long been deplorable. And workers have told this government that they were at risk, and so were their ability to properly do their job. Now we're seeing that these conditions are resulting in reduced sentences for convicted criminals. Why hasn't the minister taken this issue seriously enough to prevent this kind of fiasco from happening in our correctional system?
So there we have it. People that we might want locked up aren't being locked up.
No.
And the people that we probably don't care if they're locked up are being abused.
Yeah. Well, it's like, yeah, most people in prisons are there for nonviolent crimes. And yet they're the ones who are dealing with all of these deplorable conditions that nobody should have to live in.
And I got to tell you that if you right now are driving down the street, you accidentally hit someone who runs out in front of you, totally freak accident, and you're charged with vehicular manslaughter, whether you're guilty or not, you will be in EMDC waiting for trial. Any one of our listeners at this moment can end up in EMDC in a heartbeat.
That's so scary.
And then you talk about some of the platons, like one we're going to hear later. He came out with head trauma and lifetime disability for being in EMDC. Let's listen to a couple. These are, thanks to the London Free Press, these are two of the EMDC plaintiffs in the court case that Kevin has got forward that presented yesterday at Tollpuddle for the criminal justice work that's been done in London this week.
Me.
This is what it's like
to be me.
To be me.
This is what it's like to be me.
As soon as I got in there, I knew something wasn't right when the guards were telling me that that this is not a normal place, and the inmates have rules. They're posted on the wall, which they were right there, right from the beginning. You knew that it wasn't going to be good. And as soon as I got in, I told you I went in with two other inmates. The inmates told the guards these two are not staying here, take them out. I knew right there that the guards didn't control this place.
I got beat up for myself. I had urine thrown on me. I had my food taken from me. And it was hard. That place is a hard place. Some days I wish I was dead when I was there.
How many times were you beat up?
Oh, a lot. No, I suffered two concussions in one day. They didn't take me to the hospital. I got scars in my head that I'll have for the rest of my life because they were pretty deep.
So I went to use the phone, and I picked up the phone, and then they just come rushing me, and I blacked out, woke up in the washroom, yeah, my face tore apart here, and it was like just open to back to there. They give me these bandages. I bandaged up, and they told me not to say anything, cover your face.
Friday fight night, you would get two guys saying, you and you fight. The one that has, the loser has to leave, and the winner makes a name for himself.
As soon as you get there, the bullying starts. It's controlled by gangs, and they beat people to show any new people or anything, this is how it is. It's just gang controlled.
Some days I said I wish I was back in the penitentiary, because the shit that happens there, it doesn't happen. But here, it happens.
But they have plastic trays and they'll break pieces off them.
Sure. With us here is Robert Broly. Hello, Robert.
Hello, good morning.
We're going to call you Rob today. Is that okay?
That's
because
fine.
We've got three of us in here. We outnumber the Kevins, so we win. Now, you were incarcerated at the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, I was. Yes.
Rob, tell us about your experience and how you ended up in there and what happened to you. First of all, before you do that, What has given you the courage to come forward to do this? You're obvious. This is not an easy thing to do. Can't be.
No. It started off basically for getting compensation for what has happened to me out there. But then when I found out that people had sons and daughters and dads that didn't make it, I talked to one, and she said, you be the voice, because he can't. And so it's gone beyond the money thing, the compensation. It's absurd. People are dying, maimed, disabled for life. And I can answer why there's no cameras in there, because they don't want to be held accountable. They know what's going on. Sometimes the guards are participating in it. I've seen it. What happened to me in 2004, I was struggling with an addiction. I kited a check for approximately $600, and I was sentenced to 30 days in Ogden Middlesex Detention Center. During the time before that, I had a little small home maintenance business that I did around the city, cleaning yeast troughs and pressure washing, that sort of thing. And when I was in the general population, they have what's called yard, where you go out and you circle around in enclosed concrete walls, and it's your yard time where you get out of the cells. And all the inmates that want to go out there, and there's guards that supervise you, and you kind of walk around in circles. And I heard Rob over my shoulder, and I looked back, and I'm not going to mention names, but this officer, I'd done yeast trough cleaning every year at his house. So he's like, you know, come here. So I went up, kind of shook his hand, and he's always a good man. He had a family, and we always got along good. I didn't know he was a guard.
Right.
He was like, I never thought you'd be here. He said, what'd you do? I said, I made a mistake. And so didn't think anything about it. I said bye and kept walking. And then when I got upstairs, I was cornered. And you got a picture, the cell, the common areas are like a pie-shaped. So they have one corner's kind of, it goes to a point, and the rest comes out, and there's two doors. And so they cornered me, and they said, how do you know that guy? And I said, well, didn't think anything of it. I said, I did work in this house. And it is maintenance. And they said, we want his address. And I basically, then they looked like they were just ready, very angry, very violent type of postures. And I said, no. I said, sorry. Actually, I'm not going to say what I told them to say. I did say.
Mm-hmm.
Told them to go themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And they're actually asking you for the address of this guard.
Officer,
you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I didn't know why at that point. Now, come to find out that the three of them had called the officer in question a gay or what do you call it? I'll be honest with you, straight up, a faggot.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they took a swing at the guard. Well, next thing you know, the four or five, six guards put these guys in the hospital at Vic. Okay? So they wanted to find out where he lived to pay back and visit him and his family. That was the gig. But I didn't give it up. Now, we went to eat dinner, and they lock you down, supposedly to protect you, because a lot of people were stealing people's meals. When the carts came in, they're sitting out there, and the bigger guys were taking the trays and going, all right, kid, you're going hungry. So they lock you down the cell, and they bring in the cart. Okay, but now it doesn't make any sense now, because they bring in the carts, and the senior inmates distribute the food, and the guards leave the cart and walk out, and they go do their thing, and they come back and pick up the cart when everybody's done feeding. So if you've pissed off these senior inmates, then your cell is bypassed, and you don't get to eat. And if you complain, they kick your head in. So I'm sitting here playing chess after watching your guard in front of the TV. And they have a history over there. What they do is they come up behind you with a towel. And they will actually physically put it over your head and twist it from behind so they can run you around like a chick. You can't see. You can't do anything. Once you get the control of something.
Right over your eyes and everything.
They tried to put it over my head from the back. And I quickly realized what was happening, and I got my thumb underneath it, and I pushed up. By that time, I'm taking shots on either side, and my feet are like a picnic bench. You know how your feet are underneath here? So I got myself up, and I honestly say today I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for some martial arts training. I was fighting these guys. I could finally see, and I'm hitting them, they're hitting me, they're sweeping my feet out, they're sweeping the thing, and they're punching me, I'm punching them. And then in the meantime, I'm backed up against the doors. There's two doors for exits and entrance. I'm beating on it with one foot against the thing as I'm fighting these guys, saying, key up, help, help. I mean, I got five guys on me. I'm coming here, how skilled you are. I was losing. And the guy said, hey, and I looked to the right, and he took a cup that was just packed with wet toilet paper and palmed it. And basically when I said, hey, and I looked over this way, he basically smashed it into my face. And instantly the blood was squirted out everywhere. They all ran back to the corner of their little pie sheet there. There was all 60 of them. I'm beating on the thing, and I'm going from door to door, and I'm looking at the blood trail that's going. It's just, I can't stop it. So I look down, and I see the towel that they tried to kill me with. It was the towel that saved my life. And I put it up to my face, and I kept beating and beating. Finally, they came in, and coincidentally, the officer that had said hi downstairs, down there, was like, oh, my God, Rodney. And then he pulled the towel up, and he said, don't move. Oh, my God, don't move. And I could just see the blood trail. It was disgusting. I couldn't see out of this eye. So they rushed me to the hospital and brought me back. That's another thing there. They did the CAT scans and all this, and then he sewed me up. But by the time the plastic surgeon got there, I couldn't work on me because my head was so swollen. I suffered 3 cranial fractures to the skull, 27 stitches, just look this way, mm-hmm. along there underneath my eye. So when they basically, the cup was curved like that, when they smashed it like that, they're considered indestructible. That's why they bought them. But they're actually weapons. Might as well give the guy a knife when he comes in here, because I've seen people, what they do is they put it, they stack it with wet toilet paper and stick it in a sock. And that's just like hitting somebody with a cue ball over the head. Okay. And I've seen it many times. It's just a crack of the skull. And when it cracked me, it was a crack like a... Mm-hmm. It was unreal. So anyway, I came back from the hospital. They sewed me up. They didn't do anything. They were just... The attitude there was... the police officer did come and said, who was it that did it? And at that point, I was like, I don't know nothing, man. I didn't give up the officer's name, and I'm not telling who did this. I was scared out of my gourd because I couldn't. At that point, my face had swollen up where I couldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm stuck. I'm at other people's mercy, and now they're going to bring me back to the institution. All right? And everybody knows it's if the guards and the inmates, I mean, they're two different things. That's like God and the devil. You don't talk to them, you keep your mouth shut. So they had put me into a place, an infirmary. No, it was infirmary. They didn't have an infirmary there. They put me in solitary confinement. And they came, and a couple of officers came in and said, right, Rob, you didn't tell them. You didn't tell them the address. I said, no, I didn't. He said, and that's when I found out what the officer that came into my cell that I did work for told me what had happened a year and a half ago with these particular inmates. It was kind of a bad setup that I didn't know. And so they put me in this solitary confinement cell, and I couldn't see at that point. And if it wasn't for Bernie Dewar of Justice and Correctional Service of Salvation Army, a friend of my parents in Florida, he lead me around by the arm. I was scared out of my gourd. I wouldn't go anywhere because I couldn't see. And walking down the halls to their little checkups or whatever, he was a blessing. But I tell you what, I didn't realize what I was into, but the solitary confinement, there was a guy that had mental health issues, and he took his feces and did the caulking around the cells and over the air vents.
Oh, geez.
And they put me in there. I couldn't see, but I could smell every time I go to eat, mm-hmm. especially around the door. I was really hot, and I was trying to take a pencil. I couldn't see, trying to clear the airways, because sometimes they put wet toilet paper up over them because it gets too cold. And I didn't know what I was doing, but when I could see, eventually, after a month, well, it wasn't a month, it was about 2.5-3 weeks.
You were in there for that period of time.
Oh, yeah, they didn't release me. They kept me. Yeah.
Richard, wasn't your term just 30 days?
Yes, it was.
And how many days did you serve?
Okay, I served, was 20-something, but this incident happened like 2 days into my sentence.
Oh, I see.
So it was like 2.5 weeks later when I could actually see again. I was just brutal. I was like, I protected you, but they were mad at me because I wouldn't tell who did it. Even though they had blood splatter on the guys, they said I didn't press charge, I didn't that, because at that point I was in fear of my life. You know, if I told on them, I mean, were they going to pass word down to the people that are in solitary confinement? And then, you know, no. When I go to take a shower, I
now,
get it.
What I'm hearing here is these guys in that prison, the actual prisoners, everyone there is there for 2 years less a day. Is that the idea?
Well, that would be the maximum, yes.
So that means they're going to be released into the community again at some point in time, theoretically.
Right. I mean, they may be holding people who are destined for a penitentiary, but anyone serving a sentence there would be 2 years or...
Dang. So, and it's... Some of the stories I'm hearing are eerily similar. I mean, it's just, it's the fact is that kids, say if you're gay or whatever, and I'm, to each his own, personally I'm heterosexual, they don't get fed. and they have no control because the guards that bring the carts in, and these guys, the kids are starving. I mean, they're not being fed because the senior inmates are the one distributing the food, and if they don't like you or they think you're whatever, you're not going to eat. And then if they can't bitch, they can't express their concern, because then the guards, they laugh and walk away, and then they get dragged in the shower and their head beaten against the thing. I mean, it's just...
Thanks to Michael Smith, Glenn Johnson, and Robert Broly for telling their stories.
Wow.
Of the conditions that they face in EMDC. And, you know, think back that these attacks happen daily in that facility. And here is someone who went to a banking machine and pulled out $400 that wasn't his and got sentenced to 30 days to pay for his drug addiction. Okay? Out of that 30 days, he has a brain injury, he can't function normally, and he is on ODSP and on disability for the rest of his life. So not only those of you that are tax conscious, not only did we not get any bang for our buck there, we're now subsidizing this individual for the rest of his life because we stuck him in a situation where he got hurt.
Yep. A situation that not only could have been prevented in many ways, but a situation where he could have gotten much better help for his situation to begin with that didn't involve sticking him in a place like that, right? Like, again, how does that actually help people who are in situations where they might commit what we call a crime, right? Whether you consider it a crime personally or not, right? I mean, the law is kind of messed up in that way, but...
Yeah, we know you have a different view of the law.
Yeah.
Our anarchists on the air. But you know, in this case, he did break a law.
Yeah.
A small one.
Yep.
And he paid the rest of his life for it. And just think, he had a guard that was his friend.
Yeah, that couldn't even save him. Like, that didn't do anything for him, knowing a guard. Like, it's...
I mean, you look at the guards that are refusing medical care, refusing drugs. So if a trans person comes in, they won't give them their hormones. They stick them in solitary confinement. They can't keep anybody safe, and the prisoners run the place. I mean...
Basically, yeah. It's not a place where people get rehabilitated. It's a place where people are put in an environment where they have no choice but to react violently and to experience violence and make other people experience violence, right? Even with, like, the alliances that build in prisons, like, that... I mean, that's a whole other thing, right, is prison culture. And, like, how does that prevent future crimes? How does that rehabilitate anyone? How does that better society in any way? And like you said, that's what our tax dollars are going towards. So, I mean, even if people don't have empathy for the people who are in there, you're still the one contributing to that without any, like, by no fault of your own, right? I mean, people have to pay taxes, but, like, that's... Still, that's what you're contributing to. That's what we're all contributing to. That's what the system does.
Yeah, and you got to understand, this is the facility that if you have a driving offense and you can't pay the fine and you go to jail for weekends out of provincial offenses court for minor vehicle traffic stuff, this is the jail you're in every weekend for your time. Like, there's some bad people in here, but there's also just... You know, the average Joe that has traffic offenses.
Yeah, or somebody who's poor and can't afford to meet their basic needs, right? Like, I mean, these are all problems that can be solved some other way.
Exactly. Like, you know, and that's just intolerable. And, you know, conservative MPPs and I don't see eye to eye. And the tape that
really?
You just heard came from Just Right, which is our right-wing radio station here at the station, and I very rarely have any material out of those guys that I can use on our show. But thanks to Just Right for the interview with Robert Brawley at the end of that clip. And I got to say that I fully and completely agree with MPP Jeff Urich and this clip calling for the resignation.
To the Minister of Community, Safety, and Correctional Services. Yeah. Minister, you have grossly mismanaged our jail systems in Ontario. You've closed jails in Walkerton, Owen Sound, and Bluewater without enough capacity to safely absorb the inmates. Rather than fixing problem jails, you close them. Given your track record, people in my area think you have no interest in actually fixing the problems at EMDC. Many think you'll ignore the problems until you can officially close the jail. Minister, when do you intend to close the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center?
First of all, Mr. Speaker, let me thank all the correctional officers and the staff at AMDC. They're doing an extremely good job. It's not an easy job to do, and I wanted to thank them for all the good work that they're doing. As you know, Mr. Speaker, and as I said yesterday, the health and safety of our staff in our correctional facility in EMDC is my utmost priority. And I know that they are always working in a very challenging environment. And actually, one of my first visits, as I was appointed Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services, was at EMDC. And I met the leadership there, I met representatives from the correctional officer, and I saw firsthand, you know, the good work that they are doing over there. Thank you.
Supplementary.
Thank you, Speaker. Back to the Minister. Minister, as you know, the situation in the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center came to a head last night. Correctional officers, insulted by your comments, locked down the jail. Two fires broke out. A green alert occurred, of which there have only been two in the past 22 years, and it was issued. And a number of inmates were reportedly sent to the hospital. The correctional officers at EMDC worked day in and day out in dangerous conditions. Conditions made worse by your mismanagement. Yet yesterday, you refused to take responsibility and instead threw our frontline corrections officers under the bus and insulted all the managers around the province. There's absolutely no excuse for your failure on this file. Minister, will you admit that you have no credibility on this file, publicly apologize, and resign?
Hear, 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 hear. This has been Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. If you want to see any of our other shows, then check out our blogs at www.betweenthemargins.ca. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Bailey Lamont.
And I hope you have your happily ever after, whatever that means to you.